Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Order Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:28 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 26th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off this week and look at the total of negative yielding bonds because it hit a peak back in August of last year at approximately 17 trillion. And it's now back up to about 13 trillion, having been as low as 9 back in March. So there is obviously a clear reason for this, that a number of the bonds that had popped back up into positive yielding territory have fallen back into negative yielding territory. There's a clear desire to hedge against deflationary risk, and that is buying bonds now because investors are willing to bet that interest rates will fall further. And there has been a clear trend of interest rate cuts all over the world. This isn't simply a developed market US, UK, European or Japanese phenomenon. It's everywhere has been cutting interest rates. And it's not just that they're cutting interest rates either, but there's a large number of countries are now engaged in quantitative easing as well. So, for example, we can look at, the Ukraine. They've cut interest rates by over 700 basis points. For Turkey, which in many respects was on the cusp of default not so long ago, they've already cut interest rates by about 3.75%. Poland has bought back enough of its bonds to account for about 4% of its GDP. And these are really quite significant purchases, but what it is also suggesting is that there is a scramble on to capture a positive yield while they're still available. And that is one of the reasons why the stock market has also been able to do well. And more on that in a moment. But I do think it is worth just spending a little time to think about what exactly is going on in terms of the government bonds right now. So, for example, German Bunds are still yielding about a negative 48 basis points. But the trend is downwards, and the yield did push down to a new reaction low in here today, and there's potential that we could see further compression. The 10-year gilt has been pretty much going sideways above zero for the last 4 months, but there is still downward pressure. And while the yield ticked up marginally in here today, the trend is still clear, and nothing has really happened to question the consistency of the decline. And investors are willing to bet that the Bank of England isn't going to have much option but to move into negative yielding interest rates. What's, I think, particularly interesting is that the Anglosphere generally has been doing everything they can to avoid negative interest rates. But because interest rates are falling all over the world, it's putting downward pressure on yields everywhere. And investors are very clearly suggesting that we're going to have a deflationary outcome for at least the near term. But what that's also doing is compressing the borrowing costs of governments as they engage in massive stimulative measures, whether that is deliberately to further compress their yields by trying to buy the bonds, or whether it is to engage in fiscal stimulus. Because the velocity of money is so low, we're unlikely to have a big inflationary outcome. But what we are starting to see is that some of the efforts that are underway in order to manage the yield curve are primarily focused on the 10-year. So when we look at, for example, the 10-year yield in the US, it's at about 63 basis points. And it has now broken the very mild upward bias evident since the beginning of April by pulling back in here today. It's at 63 basis points, but when we look at the 30-year, then we are presented with another chart where the sequence of higher reaction lows has been broken, but the yield is comparatively higher at about 1.36%. Now, One thing that we can compare is that the trend is the same, and there has certainly been an acceleration in the compression of the yield over the course of the last 12 months, and it is quite similar to the compression in the yield that we had back in 2007 down to the lows in 2008. The difference, of course, or at least the similarity so far, is that even though the yield popped back on the upside into June of 2009, it did not move on and break the downtrend. And we're at an interesting juncture right now because it has pulled back from the region of the trend mean. It failed to push back above the 2% level, and it's broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. We're seeing some additional contraction. In fact, we're seeing contraction in government bonds everywhere. And that's as true of the USA, Europe, the UK, as it is of Australia. And the Australian government bond yield is down to 86 basis points. It's still one of the higher yielding developed market government bond markets. Well, what that also suggests is that there is still ample scope for additional compression. So there is still potential that we're going to see additional moves higher in government bond prices because of this desire to hedge deflation risk. And because interest rates are so low, then the sensitivity of longer dated bonds to that are really quite acute, and it does help to inflate their prices more. Of course, they are more susceptible subsequently to inflationary pressures. The one thing that I think is particularly noteworthy is the fact that the Japanese 30-year yield is actually moving higher. And it is one of the only major government bond markets where yields are in fact rising. And it was in mildly positive territory again in here today, back above the 50 basis point level. And this looks like a breakout. And there's been a sequence of higher reaction lows for about 9 months already. Well, there is therefore the potential that investors are perhaps willing to give more credence to the potential that Japan might have some form of inflationary outcome than just about any other country. Now, that's rather contrary to everything we've seen over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. But what it is perhaps also a reflection of is that the yield control measures that have been implemented, whether overtly or covertly, are primarily aimed at the 10-year yield. And they pay less attention to the 30-year. So perhaps the 30-year in Japan is giving us a better reflection of exactly what is going on. Now, we've certainly seen that COVID-19 cases have been rising. That's certainly true in India and emerging markets. It's also true of approximately 100 million or states that represent 100 million people in the USA, Florida, Texas, Canada, California, excuse me, and Arizona. Well, that is likely to have an economic impact because it's necessitating that lockdown measures will no longer be further eased and they may have to be tightened. Both Texas and Florida tightened up their easing in here today, so that's certainly one of the factors in the downward pressure we've seen on stock markets. One thing, though, that I think is particularly relevant is when we look at the differential in terms of the yield between US 10-year treasuries and the S&P 500, well, it's at about 137 basis points. Now, that yield is expanding further because of the downward pressure we're seeing on the 10-year yield, but perhaps also because of the potential for an additional pullback in the S&P 500. Subscriber very rightfully pointed out that we have island reversals on the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrials. And island reversals are noteworthy. You don't see them all that often. And when we do see them, well, it tells us that there's a lot of indecision in the market, because in order to form one, you need a breakaway gap, which is usually significant in terms of enthusiasm for the market, which is very quickly reneged upon, and we get a downward gap, which is representative of people taking profits and initiating short positions. Now, the big question is, and we are at very big psychological levels for the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, 25,000 on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. For the S&P 500, it's at the psychological 3,000 level, and the NASDAQ 100 at the 10,000 level. But they are all now testing those levels. Then, when we look at some of the leading individual stocks, on Google today we had a downside weekly key reversal. That is confirming resistance in the region of 1400, and this is potentially a lower high. It's a pretty similar condition on Facebook. It had a downside weekly key reversal, and this is looking potentially now like a failure of the breakout. The last time that, and in fact, I think it is worth highlighting that Facebook has been prone to downside weekly key reversals. We had a significant one in 2018. We had another significant one at the peak in January of this year, and this is another one. The problem with some of the social media companies is that they have a great deal of uncertainty attached to them as a result of accusations of electoral tampering back in 2016, and the fear that they will be utilized again to deploy ad campaigns that are micromanaged and very much targeting emotional responses from individual people that are very single issue oriented but tend to sway public opinion. And those are the kinds of strategies that won the election for President Trump the last time around, and there is obviously a clear effort underway to avoid that happening on this occasion. Well, it does. Then, of course, you have the fact that there is a strong campaign underway to stop buying advertising from Facebook. Unilever pulling advertising from both Facebook and Twitter in here today is part of the reason why we've had this pullback. But these are companies that have got a growing risk of antitrust. Then, when we look at some of the other companies like Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft, they have been unable to hold all of their advances in here this week. But I do think we have to just consider that we've had a very impressive rally over the course of the last 3 months. We have short-term overbought conditions, so there is clear potential for an additional period of consolidation. That's equally true of Microsoft, which is pausing in the region of the psychological 200 level. And then we have Apple, which has also done really fantastically well over the course of the last few months, and is pausing in the region of $350. Well, one thing that we can certainly say is that we had the island reversals on the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones, and now they're back in the region of big psychological numbers. I was leery of the S&P being able to push through the 3,000 level back in May. It subsequently did so. Now, that region should offer support, and we're likely to find out next week whether these big psychological levels, whether 3,000, 10,000, or 25,000 on the S&P, NASDAQ, and Dow Jones industrials are in fact going to hold. Now, if they fail, well, then the potential is that we're going to have a deeper process of consolidation. And that could then create a more significant higher reaction low if we are still in a recovery scenario. But then, of course, we have other indices that have not been able to push back above their respective trend means. And the Russell 2000 is one of those. And a point I've been making for most of the last few months is that there is an enormous commonality between what's going on the Russell and what's going on in Europe. And of course, the one thing that they both share in terms of that commonality is that none of the FANG shares are listed there. So perhaps they offer more of a picture into exactly what's going on in terms of the wider global market. This rebound back to the region of the trend mean and a very impressive move off the lows in March has been characterized by a reasonably consistent advance. We've had ranges one above another on the FTSE 250 and on most of the European indices and really on the Russell 2000 as well. And we would need to see the price dropping down out of this range in order to confirm that we're moving into a more corrective phase and that there is the potential that the lows could then be retested. Well, the big question, of course, is whether then we'll start to see some of these indices finding support. Now, let's then just take a somewhat longer-term view. One of the most important points is that the 200-day moving average is now below the 1,000-day moving average for the FTSE 250, and that's not something that happens all that often in a secular bull market. So it is for the bulls to prove in here that the lows can hold and that subsequently prices can recover. If we then think about the wider European markets, well, we haven't yet seen the 200-day fall through the 1,000-day, but it's really not that far off it. Then the Russell 2000 is also at a rather critical juncture in terms of this significant crossing activity. But when we then think about the Nasdaq, it has still got plenty of room in which to consolidate and still be above the 200-day moving average. So it's a completely different picture. We certainly have got this very clear loss of uptrend consistency, and even with the reversion towards the mean, still a lot of work to do on the vast majority of global indices. But the technology sector, which has been led higher by the mega cap companies that benefited most from the lockdowns, has got more room in which to consolidate. Then when we think about the S&P 500, it bounced from around the 1,000-day moving average, spent 4 weeks below it, and then pushed back upwards. Now, we might yet see a consolidation between the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average if it fails in the region of 3,000. And that would characterize a higher reaction low if it's successful. But obviously, then if it fails at 3,000, the next area of potential support is around the 1,000-day moving average. Now, one thing we can also think about is that banks generally are liquidity providers. But bank shares have failed to push back up into the overhead range and pulled back rather violently over the last 3 weeks from the region of the trend mean. They have been buffeted over the last 24 hours by the moratorium on share buybacks and the curtailment of their ability to pay dividends. So investors are exiting the sector because they're being deprived of their income. But of course, banks also had the Volcker Rule eased, so they should have more cash available to engage in liquidity issues, but that may not be enough to help their shares. The underperformance of banks is not really a great sign for the wider market, because bull markets thrive on liquidity. And liquidity is really the name of the game. It's one of the factors that has been compressing yields internationally. But then when we think about the total assets of central banks, it has rallied very significantly over the course of the last few months, but now it has paused. And having tacked on about closer to 5 trillion over the course of the last 5 months, now the measure is simply going sideways, and it has been going sideways for 3 weeks. The size of the Fed's balance sheet was updated after the close yesterday, and it didn't go anywhere. It, in fact, just declined by a very small amount. Now, the Federal Reserve has said that they are going to purchase $120 billion of bonds and mortgages a month. But so far in June, and we're on the 26th, they haven't bought any. So that rather suggests that the Federal Reserve is keeping its powder dry, that they are probably doing a wait and see. I think it was last week's Friday audio, what I described it as was an inverse of the uptick rule. The Fed would appear to be waiting for weakness to occur in the stock market before mounting additional stimulative measures. We saw something like that 2 weeks ago when we had that pullback on the S&P 500 that created the island reversal. Then we had the Federal Reserve come out and say that they are going to buy individual bonds as well as buying ETFs. And that supported prices for a while. Then we had the pullback 2 days ago, and yesterday the Fed came out and said that they were going to ease the Volcker rule. So now the question is, are they going to come out with additional measures on Monday or over the weekend to support prices to hold this 3,000 level? Because there is now a lockstep reaction between investors and liquidity. When additional liquidity measures are announced, we'll see prices appreciate. If there's a reluctance to provide additional stimulative measures, then prices are likely to ease back down. And most particularly because the news about the coronavirus is getting worse rather than better. And that, I think, is one of the risks that are still outstanding, that we simply don't have a handle on it yet, that the enthusiasm about a V-shaped economic recovery is waning. We've certainly had something approaching a V-shaped stock market recovery, but it's possible we're going to have a U-shaped economic recovery, and I think that's something that is probably going to get priced into markets. If we don't see it priced into markets, it will be because of additional liquidity measures. Now, when we think about liquidity, it comes from three primary sources. The first is straight out central bank printing and government spending. And when we look at what's happening in the USA right now, they have been responsible for more than half of all stimulative measures globally. They are talking about another significant fiscal stimulative package that could have assistance for homeowners. It may entail an additional stimulus check for everybody. It could be any of a number of different potential outcomes, but it hasn't been agreed yet. Then we have the willingness or otherwise of the Federal Reserve to continue to buy bonds. They've said what they want to do or what they're going to do, but we don't have any evidence that they're in fact doing it. Well, that's the primary reason why we're seeing some weakness coming through. It's simple enough. It's simply a lockstep measure. Now, when we then think about banks, they're the second really big source of additional liquidity through lending. But banks are perhaps going to be impeded or from lending because of bad loans. And that's the primary reason why the Federal Reserve has banned them from buying back their own shares or from raising or even paying out dividends, because they're worried that banks are not going to be in a position to service their or to ensure that they have enough liquidity in the event that some of their loans go bad. Well, if they're failing stress tests, it's got to be because the Federal Reserve thinks that they're not going to be in a position to lend out additional funds. So that's also a hit to liquidity. We also know that the dollar index has been firmer over the course of the last 3 weeks. Now, it has broken the sequence of higher reaction lows over the last 2 years. So I do think this looks like a distribution, that we had a short-term oversold condition. The size of the rebound has been modest to date. We also had the downside key reversal on Monday and then follow through on Tuesday. Subsequently, we've had something of a rebound. It has not yet been able to push back up into this overhead range. I do think that there is the clear potential that we're going to see a weaker dollar. The counter argument to the weak dollar prognosis, or I guess hypothesis, is that every country wants a weak currency right now. And there are, I guess, there's a clear reluctance to have anyone to have a strong currency. But of course, some countries need a weaker currency more than others. And right now, the US needs a weaker currency. But because of these competitive forces, then it's one of the primary reasons why gold continues to be quite steady. And this compression in yields globally is one of the primary factors, because it reduces the competition for gold, since gold doesn't have a yield. And there is obviously potential for even more bonds to move into negative yielding territory. We're also in an environment where the seeds are being sown for an inflationary cycle. That doesn't mean that we're going to have inflation immediately. I think in the short term, deflation is much more likely, that we continue to see that we have millions of people unemployed everywhere. One of the factors in Europe that may support the dollar is that a lot of the measures that were implemented in European countries to continue to pay workers and to keep them in their jobs while the lockdowns were underway are due to expire. So either Europe is going to have to open up more fully or engage in additional fiscal spending. But the bigger picture here is that when we have governments that are spending with abandon and putting on debt as if it was wartime, well, then we are obviously going to have to address the question of how the debts are going to get paid back eventually. And inflation is going to be part of the answer. Now, one of the reasons we haven't had a big pop up in inflation over the course of the last 40 years has been because of both globalization and technological innovation. Technology is inherently deflationary, and we can certainly see that in terms of the correlation between the peak in the velocity of money all the way back in the late 1990s and the continued compression. And that is going to collapse when it is next updated. And unfortunately, this data series is updated with, it's updated in arrears and then with a 3-month lag. So therefore, we're looking at data that's already 6 months old, and it was at a new low when it was last updated in December. Well, velocity of money is going to collapse. That's obviously going to have a clear deflationary outcome. Eventually, though, because of the lockstep measure, we simply think about the first principles of central banking, and it is to ensure that there is enough liquidity in the system to promote economic growth. When the velocity of money declines or stops, then they have no choice but to flood the market with additional liquidity. When velocity of money picks back up, they're going to be inhibited from removing that liquidity because it would cause a stock market crash. And that is where inflation will likely start to come from. And I strongly believe that that is why gold is still firm. Now, gold has been ranging below the $1,800 area for the last few months. Now, on the last, on three occasions, between 2011 and 12, it got right up to test the $1,800 area and failed. But I think we can contrast the fact that it's been ranging in this area rather steadily for the last 3 months, whereas on previous occasions it raced to get to this level. And there is the clear scope that we're going to see gold pushing on to new recovery highs and all-time highs in the next month or two because of the clear desire to hedge against an inflationary outcome, because gold simply can't be printed into existence. Now, when we look at the price of gold adjusted for purchasing power parity, then I think we're presented with a rather interesting phenomenon, because it is now approaching its peak, but not simply in terms of nominal prices, but also in terms of the much longer term purchasing power parity chart. When we go back and look at the peaks put in 1980, and then again in 2012, the closing highs, and because this is a daily chart, we're getting the spike that came through, but closing highs were very similar to each other, and now prices are pushing back up towards the peak of gold from 2011 and 12 in purchasing power parity terms as well. I do strongly think that we're really only in the foothills of a new bull market in gold, for the simple reason that one of the primary reasons that we had a bull market in gold from the beginning of the 2000s through to the peak in 2011 and 12 was because of the loss of faith in the purchasing power of the dollar and the clear willingness of central banks to abuse the purchasing power of their respective currencies to solve problems in terms of global market liquidity. And we are seeing that now amplified by the response to the coronavirus. When we think about the money printing that went on as in response to the bursting of the tech bubble, and then afterwards the bursting of the subprime bubble, then even the bursting of the sovereign of the Eurozone's credit bubble, then the kind of printing that we're seeing internationally, where this willingness to cut interest rates, boost liquidity, buy back bonds, that this is now on a scale that was previously unimaginable, and yet gold is only just beginning to respond. And it's likely to respond even more powerfully if we start to see that the other hedge is starting to underperform. When we think about the Dow gold ratio, I've been really thinking about this a lot over the course of the last month, because we just have not seen this kind of scenario before, where we've had a very meaningful pullback in terms of the long-term trend. Now, this ratio has now been trending downwards for 2 years already, and it does raise very important questions, because if we think about the long-term history of the ratio, it has given us a really great example of cyclicality in markets, where we have got at approximately 35 years between the peaks. Each of the peaks was above the last, and that the uptrend was pretty much uninterrupted in terms of its power and strength. But that is just not the case any longer. We've had a very meaningful pullback over the course of the last 2 years, where gold has outperformed the Dow in a really quite impressive fashion. So while we have still got a very narrow outperformance by the mega cap shares, and the NASDAQ has continued to outperform, we can then look at the long-term chart of the NASDAQ versus gold. And even here, gold, it might be more range-bound, but there is a clear sequence of lower rally highs in favor of gold, where the NASDAQ has been underperforming gold for the last 2 years already. One thing I think is different on this occasion is that previously significant bull markets in precious metals have been accompanied by significant bull markets in industrial resources as well. But when we look at the performance of the tickers that I'm trying to pull up, I'm afraid I can't remember them. But when we think about how well the continuous commodity index has done, and that is an unweighted commodity index versus the performance of the NASDAQ, well, then we still have a very clear uptrend for the NASDAQ versus industrial resources. So it does ask some big questions. Is this a clear acceleration? I think we can certainly say yes. Is it because this is a completely different scenario where gold is capable of rallying on its own because of its unique monetary metal characteristics? Or are we in a different scenario where gold is rallying first and that industrial resources will pick up afterwards? Well, there is then a third potential possibility, and it is that the deflationary aspects of technology, where the entire just business model of technological innovation is to do more with less, so that technology is inherently deflationary, which is keeping a lid on interest rates and contributing to disinflation on a global basis, and that the response to the coronavirus is kicking that into overdrive. Then we also have the potential that technological innovation is not going to stop. And we have also started to see that the implementation of technological solutions has been greatly accelerated. Now, we can look at it from two different ways. The first, of course, is that because of this acceleration, that it is pulling earnings forward from future years so that the technology sector will underperform in future years. It's also cannibalizing the wider economy because we're seeing that the number of bankruptcies of brick-and-mortar stores has greatly accelerated this year. Even Microsoft has shelved its retail network in here today, but the number of brick-and-mortar operations has massively contracted this year. Dematerialization is a very significant factor as well, so that there just simply isn't the same need for physical products and infrastructure. Dehumanization is what we might think of as the protest movement and certainly the rebellion against the loss of jobs. Now, that has not yet found common cause with anti-technology. Rather, it is looking more at anti-racism, anti-globalization, and anti-inequality. But sooner or later, people will come around to the idea that their jobs are being taken over by technological innovation. There is a significant event out there somewhere in the future where level 5 autonomous driving is going to become realizable. It's looking increasingly likely that both Tesla and Waymo are up to about level 4 autonomous driving. That's part of the reason why Tesla has been able to get up to $1,000. Quite whether it is going to be capable of holding on to that $1,000 mark is another question entirely when there is some question, there are being questions asked about the sustainability of the rebound. Now, there is obviously this big question then. What is going to placate the popular protests? It could be infrastructure development. And will infrastructure start to play more of a role? Because infrastructure development and commodity price appreciation is obviously something that would help to support the bull market in precious metals. But I think there is the scope that we may not see it, or at least not see it yet. And I think that's one of the more important points. When we then think about what happened in the last bull market, well, commodities really did take off in late 2001. So it was a broad commodity-led bull market because of increasing demand from China and supply inelasticity. Right now, I think it would be hard to argue with the view that we don't have any evidence that this is a sustainable rebound in commodity prices just simply based upon the broad unweighted chart. There are clear examples of recovery and are, I suppose, nascent recovery in some of the industrial or the individual industrial metals, primarily copper and nickel, but those are also heavily reliant on the growth of the electric vehicle market and battery technology. And battery technology is another very deflationary development because once we get up to scale and the number of batteries that are out there starts to increase, it's going to create a tertiary industry in terms of recycling. We'll have more at-home refueling, so there will be less need for filling stations. These cars tend to have fewer parts, last longer, and the primary drivetrain. There's the potential that we're going to be up to a million mile warranty battery in the next 18 months. Well, that is going to greatly reduce the need for servicing of vehicles, which is another major employer. If we do get to autonomous driving, then the massive percentage of the population that drives as a job will be completely eradicated. Then that is going to even further enhance the need to re-educate people to find better jobs. And these are massive social issues. And the typical government response is massive money printing. Well, we may need more infrastructure. That could be potentially the thing that will turn commodity prices around. In fact, the low commodity price is something that will encourage infrastructure development in much the same way that low natural gas prices are creating an entire hydrogen fuel cell market that is now competitive. So low commodity prices have always contributed to new sources of demand emerging. And that will also be the case for the industrial resources in the same way as it is for natural gas. But it's not an immediate outcome. So I think on this occasion, it is much more likely that gold is going to rally purely for its monetary hedge characteristics. And there is clear evidence that it is the ETF buying has continued to accelerate. It's up now over 100 million ounces. And this has been a really very significant acceleration over the last 12 months. And the quantity of gold in ETF holdings has gone up by nearly 50% in that time. So that's a very significant source of new demand, but it's also representative of money, or I guess gold supply, that's getting taken out of circulation. Now, there are questions about the efficacy of the way that ETFs have been able to source their gold, and that is probably going to be one of the factors that people were worrying about for most of the rest of this bull market. Just whether the paper gold represented by ETFs is in fact backed up by physical. But the clear trend is towards a hedge against monetary flagellation. And I think that is something that is going to continue for years to come, because it just is unlikely that governments are going to do anything to arrest the pace of money printing until they're forced to by inflation. And that is going to require economic growth. It's going to require a much more substantial rebound in economic activity. And it's not something that we're likely to see quickly because of the coronavirus. Now, the big question, of course, is when are we going to see a vaccine or a more successful treatment coming through? The NASDAQ Biotech Index was in negative territory this week, but it does look, I think, quite likely that this breakout will hold and that we are going to see additional upside. The clear runway for the development of new therapies is something that has got, I think, a lot of runway in the biotech sector. When we think about what that also means in terms of inflation or deflation, if the permitting process for biotechnology is slenderized and the clinical trials process is reformed as a result of the success, and I'm assuming that it will be successful in delivering a vaccine to the coronavirus in record time, then that represents a very significant threat to one of the biggest sectors in the world. I strongly think that it represents the same kind of game changer for healthcare that shale oil and gas represented for the oil sector back in 2010. Back then, it was and we got a lot of pushback from the contention that it was going to be a massive game changer for the energy sector and that the USA would become energy independent. Well, it is now energy independent, and that milestone was reached a year ago. There is the potential that the evolution of customized medicine and the evolution of genetic one-shot treatments for chronic conditions is going to massively break down the spending patterns on healthcare. The vast majority of countries spend meaningful portions of their GDP on healthcare every year. And that is something that could change incredibly and massively decrease over the course of the next decade. Now, if we're starting to think about, well, where could we see economic growth and the control of deficits starting to come from, it could be in the delivery of these kinds of treatments that solve for extraordinarily expensive chronic conditions. If we think about the hundreds of billions every year, and in fact it goes up to about $3 trillion per year spent on healthcare, then that represents a massive source of profit potential that could be attacked by upstart companies. It also represents a massive amount of money that we're spending that could be saved. And it could contribute to growth picking up and overtaking and helping to pay down some of the debts that are being accrued today. But whatever comes of all the debt that is being built up, inflation is going to have to be part of the reason. And I think on this occasion, we are in a very different scenario to what happened in Japan. There is a clear tendency to think about Japanification taking over the entire world. But one of the reasons why interest rates and deflation took place in Japan was because there were ample additional opportunities to take the liquidity that was being produced in Japan and invest it elsewhere for a much higher return. Well, the much higher return doesn't exist now. As recently as 2009, you could take your yen that were being printed in Japan and invest it in Australian government bonds and get 6%. Today, you're taking it and getting not much more from a 10-year Australian bond than you would be from a 30-year JGB. And now there's the competition for yield, and we have got 13 trillion of negative bonds. Well, all of that money chasing a return is something that is a tailwind for interest in stock markets, provided investors have got faith that liquidity will continue. And I do think that liquidity will be more forthcoming, simply because governments and central banks don't have a choice, and they're simply waiting for catalysts to emerge. It's likely that there is going to be a pop in the number of cases of coronavirus after the 4th of July, since it's one of the most social days of the year. Then we're likely to have some curtailment in activity because the tax payments that were due in the middle of April, are due now on the 15th of July instead. So that is going to siphon some liquidity out of the market and into government coffers. And the additional unemployment benefits that came with the CARES Act expire on the 31st of July. So those are all factors that could be catalysts for additional liquidity infusions in the form of central bank action or government action in the USA. Then we have the clear potential that Europe is going to have to continue to stimulate, and not least because of their own difficulties in exiting the lockdowns and getting people back to work, and also because of the slow recovery globally and the lack of exports into the emerging markets because of emerging market debt. The other big point is it isn't simply that you get a correlation between commodity price inflation and gold when they are trending, but usually also emerging markets tend to do well when the dollar is being devalued. Of course, they're all engaged in currency devaluation right now. I do think that we are going to see additional interest in emerging markets because that is where the growth is over the course of the next couple of years. But it's going to require then that they get past their coronavirus challenges and that their currencies start to appreciate versus the US dollar. The Nifty has continued to rebound, but it is susceptible to some additional consolidation, not least because the banking sector has been somewhat weaker in here. If banks can sustain the move above the 25,000 level, that would be really quite positive. It would suggest that we have got the scope for a type 2 bottom with a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. But I don't think that India is going to be able to rally on its own if we get additional weakness coming through in other markets. So I think we are at a more uncertain environment in the short term. But there is the clear scope that we're going to have more volatility increasing in stock markets, and the VIX index has continued to hold this 30 area, which is the upper side of the underlying base formation. So this does look like a more risky environment than we've seen in the course of the last few months. The downtrend on the VIX from the peak in March has certainly been broken. Now, if we get an additional pop on the upside, well, then that is likely to contribute to a deeper pullback in stocks, and it may offer a higher reaction low because the quantity of money that is likely to be printed in response to the challenges that are outstanding is still open-ended, and it is really only a question of when rather than if we're going to see additional spending. But gold prices are some of the most consistent on the upside anywhere, and that also is helping to stoke demand for gold shares, because in any gold bull market, investors begin to ask the question, how do you buy gold at a discount? And with gold miners able to produce at below $1,000 an ounce and gold prices approaching $1,800, then they are going to be very cash-rich companies. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.